This course is Comparative Religion. Welcome. I think we're going to have some fun here. What we're going to cover in this course are five major world religions: Hinduism, Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. It's a mere introduction to each. Any one of those done thoroughly would take more than this course devoted to it. But this will introduce you to the basic concepts and doctrines of each of those traditions. This is not a course in philosophy of religion. We will not consider arguments for or against God's existence, or we will not deal with theological conflicts of that of a philosophical nature. What we are going to do is focus on the teachings of each of these religions, and by teachings I mean theological teachings. The teachings of, that each proposes about how people are to stand in proper relation to the divine. If you want a course that examines the arguments for and against the existence of God and comes to some conclusion about all of them, then we have a course in this curriculum called Philosophy of Religion, and that's what happens there. That course does not cover Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, and so on. This one does. Now, I hope I've made clear that we're not here going to consider the history of each religion. There will be a lot of history in the covering of them, but mainly it's doctrinal. That's my focus. And there'll be enough there about the history, though, and to get you started on your own pursuit of any one of them that interests you. If you want to know more, then you'll be well equipped to go ahead and dig into the literature and get more. There's readings that accompany this course and parts of the scriptures of each of the religions. Readings commenting on them, on the tradition, and scriptures of the tradition, both. It's important that you do those readings. Now, I'd suggest that you do them this way. Do the reading, listen to the lecture, go back and do the reading again. You'll find you understand a lot more the second time than the first, but doing the reading will help you understand the lecture. The lecture will help you go back and understand the reading better. The lectures are going to cover things that are not in the reading. The readings are going to include things I don't cover in the lectures. So you need to understand that you have to do both. You have to put both together to get the full picture that you need in order to write the final exam. The course will be comparative. I've kept the old title Comparative Religion, whereas in a lot of the universities and colleges, this course is taught as the history of religion or just world religions and things of that sort, so they can get away from any idea that a comparison is actually being drawn that might be unfavorable or favorable. But this is a Christian school here, and so we're going to compare the other religions to Christianity, and we're going to take up objections to Christian doctrine and answer them and argue that they can be answered. But we have that particular point of view here, as you all know. So the first thing I think we need to do is start with the definition of religion. And I want to shift that immediately to defining religious belief, not the whole of a religion, but what is a religious belief, and how do we know when we're looking at one? Take, for example, the following beliefs. Next Friday will be payday. Last winter it was unusually warm. 1 + 2 + 3 + 4 = 10. There was an ice age about 13,000 years ago. Any of those sound like religious beliefs to you? Probably not. But one of them was in the ancient world and held by a very distinguished and influential group of people. Pythagoras and his followers, you remember him from the Pythagorean theorem, geometry. Pythagoras and his company, his group, his commune, did mathematics. And they worshiped numbers. The belief they thought was religious was 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 makes 10. And they had set that up in a figure called tetractes. 1 plus 2 plus 3, 4, no matter which way you add it up or down or across, comes out to 10. And they had a prayer to the number 10. Bless us, divine number, thou that generates gods and men. And it goes on and on. Now, what made that a religious belief, however, was not that they worshipped the numbers. It could have been religious even if they didn't. See, what we need is a definition of religious belief that's going to allow us to distinguish religious from non-religious beliefs. This is an old difficulty that's had a lot of people have a go at it. There are popular definitions of religion, and there have been scholars who have tried to propose definitions as well. Some of the popular ones think it's any belief in a god or gods, but there are lots of religions that don't have any gods. Brahmin Hinduism and Theravada Buddhism have no gods, for example. So that can't be the definition. Some people think it's just enough to say that there's a higher power. But a higher power doesn't need to be anything religious at all. I mean, if it's just you and a rhinoceros in an arena, the rhino's the higher power. Doesn't make it have anything to do with religion. Some of the scholarly attempts haven't been much better. One of them, it was proposed by the Supreme Court of the United States in some findings it held in the 1880s and 90s. It spoke of the U.S. as not endorsing any one particular religion, but that its laws certainly assumed a supreme being. But not all religions have a supreme being either. Again, Brahmin Hinduism and Theravada Buddhism don't have a supreme being. That's not the way they think of the divine at all. So, that can't be the definition. One scholar said it's the sum of all higher feelings is what religion is about. I assume he meant by higher feelings above the belt rather than below, but I'm not sure. But I don't think it has just to do with feelings. At least the religions I know, very few of them are focused on people's feelings. Another scholar thought it was the highest value that you held. Religion is your esteem for whatever you hold in the highest value. That doesn't sound right either. For one thing, in Christianity, God is not a value. God's the creator of all values. And if you want to know what the Christian's highest value is, I guess it's to please God. But that's because the Christian believes that God is the divine reality. God is real. God has created the world. And God has offered us a covenant of love and forgiveness and everlasting life. And so we value doing good in the eyes of God. We value his approval. But the central belief in Christianity is in God. It's not in what we value. It's God himself, the creator of all values. So that doesn't fit Christianity. I think it doesn't fit other, there are other religions that doesn't fit equally. There have been a lot of those attempts. And a long, long time ago when I first started, I think it was the third year I was teaching college, I got asked to do a course in comparative religion. That would be, well, I won't tell you how long ago that was. A very long time ago. So I decided the way to start was at least find out how the field was viewed by the other scholars in it. How do they define the field? What is religion? So I got went to a couple of libraries and took out all their books of comparative religion. I filled the trunk of my car with these things and took them home and started going through them one by one by one. Just look at the beginning. How do they define it? And I found that the real old books offered definitions of religion, religious belief, so on. And they all seemed to me in the right ballpark, but not quite precise. And then as I read things that had been written more recently than those oldest ones, it said, well, those are in the ballpark, but they're not quite precise enough. So here's what we're going to do. And what they did was take three or four of the definitions and say religious belief is this or this or this or this. Just put or in between four or five of them and you've got it. And it seemed to me that didn't work at all. Then around the middle of the last century, the 1950s, 60s, the books started saying, you know what, those older attempts, they just didn't work. And what they did was resort to another view that said, it can't be defined at all. Can't be defined. So you pick up a book of comparative religion and the introduction or the preface would say, well, we don't know what the field is, but there's another book on it. I didn't find that funny or amusing at all. What do you mean you don't know what it is, but here's another book on it? If you don't know what it is, you don't know this is another book on it. Anyway, several thinkers jumped on a comment by the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, who said that we often use a word for a whole bunch of things without those things having any common property. So if you think that by the fact that we use the same word for a number of things, to cover a number of things, that there has to be a common property, that's a mistake. Sometimes they have only family resemblances. And that's what they claimed for religion. These guys jumped on that, said, here you are. There are all these different traditions. We can't find that they have anything in common, but they have family resemblances, so they can't be defined. Now we don't have to worry about that problem. And that really hit me the wrong way. First of all, Wittgenstein didn't say it's always true that when you use a word like religion or sport or anything else, that it covers things that have only family resemblances. He didn't say it. They never have a common property. Often they do. We use terms like electron also and water. And all instances of them have common properties. Electron has a negative charge. That's true of all of them. It's a common property they have. Water, wherever we find it, has a makeup of H2O. Okay. So he didn't say that all the times when we use a word in common for a bunch of things, they don't have a common property. He said, look and see if it has a common property. Well, I said, yeah, that's what we ought to do. Look at it again. And as I kept looking at it and reading about all these traditions, trying to get a bead on them for this course coming up, it seemed to me that they did all have a common property. They all centered on what they thought was divine. I'm going to use that term. We could use sacred or some other term, but that wouldn't matter. They focused on a reality that they took to be the absolute reality, the ultimate reality, the reality that generated everything else. They didn't identify that the same. One religion said, well, it's this kind of thing that does that. And another said, no, no, it's this. No, no, it's that. No, it's these two over here. No, it's this whole realm of beings over here. They all had different things they put into the slot, but the slot was self-existent reality. That's what they called ultimate or absolute. What they mean is it's unconditionally non-dependent. This depends on nothing else. Well, everything else depends on it. Belief in a self-existent reality that's the origin of all else. Now, I've already mentioned, and I hope you caught it, that it doesn't mean there can be only one of these. Some religions, there are two. And one part of reality depends on one, and one part of reality depends on the other. Or they can have two self-existent divine realities, and all things depend on both of them in different respects. Or you could have a whole realm of divine beings. Many Native Americans, Native Indian Americans, had believed in a realm of divine beings. Well, they're self-existent, and the rest of reality isn't. It depends on the self-existent reality. I find that that works. It certainly works in the five religions we're going to cover, but it works in dozens and dozens of others as well. I've combed through the tribal religions in Africa, of the South Sea Islands, ancient religions in Babylonia, Egypt, and the Near East. I've checked out the traditions among the Inuit in the around the polar ice, North Pole. Everything that we can check, and there's not been an exception yet. And there's a very impressive list of thinkers that have arrived at the same conclusion in your reading. It includes William James, and Paul Tillich, Robert Neville, and quite a number of others, very distinguished people that have all come up with the same thing. Religious belief is focused on self-existent reality. What is it that everything else depends on? And it doesn't depend on anything. I think then if that is right, and I'm taking it that it is, and in your reading, you'll have the arguments for it. You'll see the objections against it and the objections answered and so on. If this is right, then there are two secondary senses of religious belief, depending on the first. The second is belief about how the non-divine depends on the divine. That would be a religious belief too, in a secondary sense. You've got a divinity, you have something that's non-divine. How does it depend on it? The non-divine, the divine generates it. Okay, how? In Christianity, the how is a very mysterious kind of answer. It's God has called everything into existence out of nothing. There was nothing whatever. There was only God, and then God, boom, there's creation. So God calls into existence space, time, matter, all the laws that govern the universe. That's a belief about, that's a religious belief. It's a belief about how the non-divine depends on the divine. And thirdly, it's also used, the it being the expression religious belief, it's also used to mean belief in belief about. How humans can come to stand in proper relation to the divine. I hope you can see that. But it's in your reading, you've got it. So these are two secondary senses of the term religious belief. They depend on the first, obviously. And this I found worked. No matter what religion I ever encountered, something was the divine reality. They didn't always call it that. They didn't. In some tribal religions, there are traditions that say, "Oh, everything is to goes back to the great heavens, and the heavens were generated this and this and this and the bump bump, and this is how people got here and so on and so on." And it doesn't say, and those heavens were self-existent, and therefore we regard them as divine, but it just assumed they were. Any myth that traces everything back to something and then ends has left you with wherever it ended. What it traces everything back to is can't be explained and is the self-existent reality. Sometimes they say so, sometimes they don't. The more highly developed religions that have a theology, almost they all end up saying it. So in the religions we're going to cover, Hinduism and Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, they're all going to say, this is the divine reality. They're going to identify it, they're going to tell you how they know that, and tell you how you need to live in proper relation to the divine. So, I hope that's clear. I hope that I've thought of most all the objections that might occur to you and have answered them adequately. I will say that this is a rather old definition. To give credit where credit's due, the first person I know of who ever held this view was Anaximander, a philosopher in ancient Athens. He lived about 650 BC. And Anaximander noticed that people had different ideas about what was divine, but they all had the same idea about what it meant to be divine. It meant that it was uncaused. It meant that it was eternal. It meant that it was that which everything else was generated by, and so on. And Anaximander said all of that. Werner Jaeger documents that in his book, The Theology of the Early Greek Philosophers. So I guess he's the first person to have noticed this, and we have to give him credit for it. Don't we? Yes. Yes, we do. So, I think this one works where the others don't. It doesn't commit anyone to having to believe in a supreme being. Something's divine, but it doesn't tell you what that is. The different religions all agree on what is meant by divinity. They all agree on this. But they don't agree on what it is. What is divine? Think of it this way. If we had a really close election in a particular country for the president of the country, people would disagree about who the president is if the election's close and in dispute. But they don't disagree on what it means to be the president. The office of the presidency, they can acknowledge while disagreeing about which candidate for office actually won the election. And that's an analogy here. What it means to be divine is clear in each of these traditions. What that divinity is, they dispute. It's like, who won the election? The office of divinity is clear, but which candidate is the one that properly belongs in the office is another issue, and on that they do not agree. So although some people have said in the study of comparative religion that it's what you see when you examine these religions is that they're all paths up the same mountain, that they're all taking a different route, but they're all getting to the same place. I don't find that to be true at all. What I see is they don't even agree on which mountain to climb. They're certainly not aiming at the same thing at the same place. They're not thinking of the same divinity. They can't all be right, because where they disagree, where their beliefs are logically contrary, they can't all be true. At most, one could be. They could all be false, but they can't all be true, because they're contrary. So, do the reading. Listen to the lecture. Do the reading again. And we're going to have some fun.